Michael Brown here. I am so glad we get to spend this time together on the Line of Fire. Sit back, enjoy the program. If it blesses you, share it with a friend. Have you ever heard the accusation, well, if you're really pro-life, then you would be pro-life for the baby outside of the womb. Who takes care of those kids? My guest has an answer.
It's time for The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown. Tackling the controversies, engaging the culture, challenging the status quo, and taking your calls. Dr. Brown is the director of Coalition of Conscience and president of Fire School of Ministry. Call now at 866-34-TRUTH and get into the line of fire.
When you think of Christians, you think of people today, committed Christians who are standing up for the rights of the unborn. You think of people who are going on the mission field and reaching out to the poor and the hurting. Perhaps you think of those who are standing for marriage and the meaning of marriage. But do you think of Christians, committed followers of Jesus, in the same breath that you think about adoption? And is there something about being pro-life that requires us to prayerfully consider the question of adoption? Michael Brown, thanks for joining us today on The Line of Fire. Number to call with your questions, comments, as always, 866-34-TRUTH. That's 866-348-7884. On our website, askdrbrown.org. Click on The Line of Fire. You'll have links for our guest, his ministry, his book. I'll be introducing in a moment. But we're going to talk about pro-life movement, and we're going to talk about the subject of adoption. My guest today from Kansas City is Randy Bolander, married since 1989. Randy and his wife, Kelsey, have spent their entire adult life in ministry as youth pastors, church planters, pastors, and prayer missionaries living in Kansas City, Missouri. They have the Zoe Foundation. They serve as prayer missionaries with the International House of Prayer on the leadership team of The Call, which means that we often cross paths in ministry we're doing. Hey, Randy, thanks for joining us today on The Line of Fire.
Oh, I'm glad to be with you, Dr. Brown.
Randy, tell me about your family. You and Kelsey, how many kids and any adopted kids of your own?
We do. We have seven children, ranging from a boy who's going to be 18 here in a couple weeks down to a little girl who's a little over one. Of the seven, three are adopted. And so we've got a mixed match. We've got all ages, both sexes, and all kinds of races.
All right, Randy, how is it that you got involved in the pro-life movement in the first place? Where did the burden come from that moved you to action?
We spent most of 2005 in Washington, D.C. with Lou and Therese Engel on the steps of the Supreme Court praying for the unborn. We were helping launch the Justice House of Prayer there in D.C. as part of the leadership team. And like you said in your intro, you know, we heard a lot of things, including if you were really pro-life, you would be pro-child. And, you know, sometimes those people who disagree with you the most can have a point, and you're foolish to ignore that point. And so in 2006, we returned to Kansas City, and the Lord began to challenge us with the idea of there being 4,000 babies aborted every day. And if the church wins the battle on that front, those are 4,000 babies that will suddenly be born but are no more wanted than when they were scheduled for an abortion.
Mm-hmm.
And we just felt that to put feet to our intercession meant we had to look long and hard at adoption and wonder if there wasn't a prophetic statement to be made there that there is room in a Christian home for a child. And so in June of 2006, we started inquiring and found out very quickly that the world of adoption is kind of murky and confusing, and that there are people in the adoption industry that like it that way, because the more confused you are, the less information you have, the more you need them. And we still muddled our way through it with friends and started in June, and by October, we had a beautiful little infant girl from Las Vegas.
Mm. Now, you mentioned you've got different races in your family. So what's the mix that you have?
We do.
The Bolander house.
My boys are my biologically born boys, which is a corny phrase to me because it makes it sound like the adopted ones are somehow mineral or something. But the ones that were born to us were Jackson, who will be 18. Grayson is 13. Zion is 9. Then we have Zoe, who is half African-American, half Latino. Then 2 years later, we adopted twin girls, that are half Caucasian, quarter Japanese, quarter Thai. They are Anna and Mercy. And we were home about 6 weeks with getting the twins and discovered we were pregnant.
Wow.
And so we've got Piper, who brings up the rear there. She's 10 months younger than the twins, and she thinks she's a triplet.
And what's the mix like with the kids growing up like this? What are the advantages? How do they view themselves? I mean, the kids that are biologically different than their siblings, how does it all work itself out?
Yeah, to be honest, we are just reaching in now to some of the real questions about that. If you look at all of us, clearly Zoe is not our biological child. She's a beautiful, slender girl and just a doll, but she's a different color. It hasn't been that big of an issue racially. She just doesn't know any different, and this is her family. As far as how we look at them, you know, I heard somebody say a few weeks ago at a conference, and it just struck me, my heart does not know the difference between my biological kids and my adopted kids. And Dr. Brown, I can honestly tell you, I never look at them and think of them as adopted. They're my daughters.
Mm. Now, what was happening with these kids' lives before you got involved? You said the whole adoption process is murky. It's confusing. I often hear... I was debating a rabbi friend, and he was talking about two gay men, and they took in a child in a foster home, a handicapped kid, because no one would adopt a child. And I made the comment, of course, I'm glad that they cared about the kid. That doesn't mean it's the best environment for him. But I said, I always hear about people trying to adopt and having problems, and foreign kids needing adoption, American kids. So how did you manage to do this, A, and B, why is it so confusing to just be able to adopt a needy child?
Well, there's a couple of things at work there. One is it's confusing and murky, like I said, because there's a lot of emotion involved. It's bringing a child into your home. And so because there's so much emotion involved, there's a lot of money that people are willing to pay. And because there's a lot of money being willing to pay, there are people who are willing to charge it. And if it was simple, people would figure it out for themselves. So people have a vested interest in keeping it confusing so that people will pay larger fees.
All right. Let me just jump in. Which people? Who are the people that have a vested interest in making money off of adopting children?
There are some disreputable agencies. Mm. I don't want to say all. I don't want to even say most, because there are a lot of good, solid people who want to help kids who work at adoption agencies. But there are others that realize that this is the most emotional transaction you'll ever make. And so fees are high, salaries are high, and they kind of keep people in the dark and keep the shell game moving, so you never really know what's going to happen. We managed to stumble our way through it fairly quickly. It wasn't cheap. Our first adoption cost us in excess of $30,000.
Wow.
We were missionaries. We didn't have that. We literally raised the money over a course of a couple of months. The Lord just, God is so in favor of adoption that, you know, the heavens open and he pays his way. But we also learned it doesn't have to be that expensive either. And so we learned some ways to make it cheaper along the way. But there are myths out there. People think that there are no babies available for adoption. In reality, all three of my girls would have gone directly to foster care had we not aggressively pursued them.
All right. So there are kids that are needing adoption. There's a difficult process for people to walk through in order to adopt. And your average parent is normally not thinking of adopting unless they can't have a kid for themselves. You're trying to change that. If you're trying to get people to think differently as believers, so what is it particularly that you are calling Christians to prayerfully consider?
We're calling them to prayerfully consider if there is room at their table for another child. The children are definitely out there. Our foster systems are full. Even our private adoption systems are. There are a lot of kids available. It's a matter of, are we so comfortable that we couldn't possibly care for one of these kids? There's a passage in Jeremiah where the prophet is prophesying to those that are in captive in Babylon. And he tells them, they're wondering how to live because they're not Babylonians and they live in Babylon. And he tells them, take wives, build home, pray for the peace of Babylon, because if Babylon is peaceful, it'll be good for you. But he goes on to tell them, don't believe the dreams that the Babylonian sorcerers tell you. He says, don't buy into the Babylonian dream. because the Babylonian dreams are different than the dreams of your heart. And I think largely the American church has bought into the Babylonian dream, or the American dream, that says we deserve a certain level of comfort, and that our home has to be X square feet per person, and that our disposable incomes needs to be this or that. Meanwhile, there are kids being raised in systems that are just fraught with problems. And we're trying to get people to look hard and say, have we bought into the Babylonian dream? And if we have, can we opt out and move over, make a little room at our table, spend some of the retirement fund, maybe sell the sports car, and make room for a child?
All right, Randy, we'll pursue this on the other side of the break. Friends, could it be that there's something very radical that many could do that is very simple and right there knocking at your door? Back with more. What can I do for Jesus? I want to do something, but you know, look, I'm not on the mission field. I'm not called to preach. What can I really do? I'm just here at my house, my husband and I, my wife and I, we're just raising our family, working jobs, and what can I do? Oh, our guest today has some very profound thoughts as to what many can do to make a radical difference in the name of Jesus. Michael Brown, thanks for joining us with my special guest, Randy Bolander, along with his wife, Kelsey, author of the new book, The Spirit of Adoption. Before I get back to Randy, just want to remind you now, we've got less than 24 hours. My luncheon tomorrow, Golden Corral, Haynes Mall in Winston-Salem, 12 noon. Be there. Lunch is on me. We want to meet our listeners, our friends, our supporters. Stu Epperson will be there with the Truth Team, and we'll be giving away a free DVD, a free two-hour DVD of my debate with Rabbi Shmuley Boteach on homosexuality. Trust me, that free lunch, it's going to be a great time. I'm going to share some things that are really blessed and encourage you. Let us know if you're coming, though, because seating's limited. 888-378-FIRE. That's 888-378-3473. Just give us a call. Let us know that you're coming and with how many people. And I look forward to meeting you personally tomorrow at noon. All right, Randy, before we pursue the discussion of adoption further, let's lay one other foundation for our listeners. Why is the whole pro-life movement and the fight for the children in the womb, why do you think that's so important to the Lord?
It's, in a lot of ways, it's how we view ourselves and if we're valuable or not. And the Lord looks at us with great, great value. The Lord looks at us with far more value than we do. And we believe that we've got to prove ourselves, we've got to earn it, we've got to somehow get his attention, so he looks down and goes, wow, out of the 6 or 7 billion, that one really stands out. In reality, he sees us from the moment we are formed in the womb, and he said, there's nothing a baby in a womb can do for the mother or for the Lord, but he sees value in that. And it is the great alignment that the church needs to come into is the valuing what the Lord values. And he says, I value the being. I value their soul. I value what they can be in eternity. And so our country has had just a really callous disregard for humanity as a whole, as expressed through our abortion laws. And it's one way that we can stand up and say, no, the Lord thinks about us differently, and we will value one another like he values us.
So it's not a matter of I'm valuable if I'm the best worker, or I'm valuable if I'm the most devoted person in the church, or I'm valuable if I look good or if I have political influence. You're saying that recognizing the value of a helpless baby forming in the womb, that indicates to us the incredible value that God puts on each human life.
Oh, absolutely. And the painful thing is that later in life, we actually often we recognize that value that he saw before. For example, my 4-year-old is a stunning child. She's and I know every father says that, and every father should say that, but in my case, it's absolutely true. And she's beautiful. And when we walk in a restaurant, people often, they turn their head and they look, and what they don't know is because she was a mixed-race child, they had to look long and hard for a family that would adopt her.
Mm.
And so I want to, you know, I smile. They tell me if I could have one like that, I would adopt. And I want to think, where were you? Where are you now when the hospitals are full of these babies, that if you'll go through the steps, you can have this. But she was as beautiful then as she is now before the Lord.
Got it. And the whole parallel that many would draw between the movement for the pro-life movement and carrying right up to child adoption, paralleling the mentalities in the days of slavery where slaves were not fully human beings. Is there something that the church can build on? Say, hey, look at what Wilberforce did. Look at what these others did. Here's our role as God's people in the earth today.
Oh, absolutely. William Wilberforce in England rolled out a long parchment with thousands of names before the House of Commons of people who put their name on the line and said, we believe that slavery is wrong. And we're trying to build a database of thousands of families that are saying, we will pursue adoption, we'll value children, and we'll take the steps, we'll pay the price, and we will raise the value of a child, not to the level that our nation says it is, but to the level that God says it is.
And how far along the way are you with actually making this happen? You've got the Zoe Foundation. So is this just some dream you have in your head, or are you actually seeing some momentum in terms of a pro-adoption movement among believers?
No, we're actually seeing momentum. The Zoe Foundation is about 2 years old, and it was founded to raise awareness of adoption, to raise funds and try and help others adopt and move the cause forward. One way is a family database that we're building of people that will put their name on the line and say, no, we'll make progress in filling out the paperwork. We'll start saving the money. We'll start raising the money. We'll break past our own excuses. People have a lot of excuses as to why they can't adopt. Most of them involve their own comfort. And people that are signing on are saying, I'm willing to be a little bit uncomfortable if it'll make the difference in the life of a human being.
All right, let's talk to somebody that's hearing you right now, and they're getting convicted, but they're feeling guilty, and this is hitting them as like a weight. Are you laying a trip on me? And it's something they just never thought of. They've got their family. They're devoted to their family. They've never thought of this. Can you tell me about the life-giving benefits to the family that does the adopting, not just the life-giving benefits to the child, but what
Sure.
kind of positive impact does it have on the family?
And let me say this, first of all. I don't believe every Christian family should adopt. I think that is too heavy of a burden to put on people as a whole. Mm-hmm. I think they need to hear from the Lord. I think more people should adopt than do. And I am really happy in inspiring the awkward conversations between husbands and wives as they go home saying, should we or shouldn't we? That's how you make decisions as a couple. But not everyone should. But for the one that is pondering, should I, shouldn't I, project 10, 12 years down the road. For example, my twins, I was telling you, my Zoe was about $30,000 to adopt. With the twins, we were able to do it cheaper. It was about $15,000 for the girls. With $15,000, you could buy a mediocre minivan, not a really good one. You know, if you want a deluxe model, it's going to cost you more, but you could buy a mediocre used minivan. And in 10 years, I'm going to have twin, half Asian, half Caucasian, beautiful girls who will come in and kiss my little bald head and call me daddy, and you're going to have a 10-year-old minivan. At that point, who do you think has buyer's remorse? Nobody wants that minivan. Nobody wanted it when they bought it. They bought it because they had to. But the person who invested in the life of a child will look back and say, that was the wisest amount of money and discomfort that I ever invested.
You know, Randy, I've heard people talk about adoption, not frequently, in fact, all too infrequently, but it's very rare that I'll hear someone put it in this perspective. We've got a few seconds before the break, but if you can stay on longer with us, I want to talk about your book, The Spirit of Adoption.
Certainly.
And I want to also press the issue of why people get so mad, so angry when we talk about pro-life, when we talk about the sanctity of a life in the womb and beyond the womb. I'm sure there's resistance to the call to adopt as well. Back with more.
Come to every time and tongue, it's in the revolution.
Thanks for joining us, friends, on the Line of Fire today, talking about the pro-life call to adoption. Again, as our guest Randy Bollinger has said, this is not for everyone, and it's not to lay a guilt trip on people. It's to look at as, could this be a wonderful thing the Lord is calling me to do? Could this be a wonderful way for me to live out and act out my faith? Could this be a wonderful way to be a witness for Jesus in the midst of this society? Randy, before we get back to the subject of adoption, I want you to hear a clip. This is from a college campus. The Center for Bioethical Reform was on campus. They'll have pictures of brutality during the Holocaust. They'll have pictures of brutality, say, from Rwanda, and then they'll have pictures of aborted babies. And they'll put these displays up at campuses and then very graciously just talk about what happens with abortion. And invariably, someone will testify the regret they have, either a guy for having his girlfriend have an abortion or the woman herself. But otherwise, they often meet with a lot of hostility. It sounds just like this. You'll hear this kind of protest. I remember one of my friends years ago, actually a student on Long Island, was standing in front of an abortion clinic, and a woman drives by, a grandmother with her granddaughter in the car, and screams at them with all kinds of profanity, raging, angry. You've been involved in prayer vigils, standing with life tape on your mouth, so not yelling, not screaming, not even holding up pictures of aborted babies, just standing there praying. Did you run into the same kind of anger and hostility? And if so, why do people get so mad? We're just talking about the life of the unborn. Why do they get so mad?
Oh, yeah, it's crazy. You know, we've stood on the steps of the Supreme Court. I've had things yelled in the ears of my children that I had to go home and explain to in delicate terms what those words meant. And I've, you know, they are the most hostile group of people, and I don't fully understand, because legally they're winning. What other group, you know, turns out in mass to protest and yell when in the courts they're already winning? Most people win and go home. But there's a rage there around the life issue and around self-identity and how God looks at them. It's a rage based in wanting to have control of their bodies. You know, there's the adage that we can't legislate morality, which technically maybe we can't, but we can legislate morally. And we actually do legislate morally. We make all kinds of laws based on morals. You can't murder people. That's morality based. But there is a lot of anger. But to be fair, there's a fair amount of anger on the life side too. Mark Twain said that in any great argument in life, there'll be somebody on your side who you wish was not. I've been standing there in front of the clinics, and I've seen people that I knew that yelled things that I thought, you know, that was not very Christ-like. The adoption piece is an answer that is really hard to argue with.
All right, I'm mad at you. Well, if you really care about that baby, then why don't you do something about it? All these babies want to get they get born, their mother can't care for them, the father's gone somewhere, you're just going to stick it on them. Why don't you do something? Where's your Christianity? That type of thing, but without the profanity, et cetera. All right,
yeah,
your response.
This is my daughter, Zoe. This is Anna. This is Mercy. And we've welcomed them into our home because we love children, and we're challenging other people to do the same.
What do people say when they see you with your adopted kids?
You know, it's a little funny because we have seven, which is more than the culturally allowed in America, even in the church. Basically, two are expected, three are... You know, there's grace for three. Four is an anomaly. And when you have more than four kids, you're dangerous. And so they don't quite know what to think. And that happens everywhere we go. But that's because we've got this high comfort standard, and we realize that having seven kids is going to change that a little bit. But overall, once you've said we've taken children in, it's very hard for people to argue about whether or not you really love people.
And you're out there... with your kids as a witness, be it in a prayer setting or in front of an abortion clinic, you get your whole family involved as a living witness to God's love for the family and for the children?
you know, we're going 90 different directions right now. My wife and I are doing a lot of writing and some travel and speaking. With seven kids with across the range that we have, we rarely go anywhere together. It takes an act of Congress and an aircraft carrier. but certainly their stories are there. Their faces are out there. And we're challenging others to join us, not just as a, you know, kids need homes. It'd be a good thing to do. Jesus would do it. It can be presented as a Jesus-tinted humanism. We're not saying that. We're saying it as a prophetic declaration in the Spirit. There is room at our table for more kids. Malachi 4, 5, and 6 says, at the end of the age, hearts of the fathers will turn to the children and children to the fathers. There'll be a great adoption movement at the end of the age. If there is not, the Bible says he sends a curse.
So if people get your book, The Spirit of Adoption, Randy, you take these things up. You deal with Malachi 4 and the prophetic declaration in your book, The Spirit of Adoption.
Yeah, we deal with the prophetic aspects of what it means to take a child into your home, some of the practical aspects, some of the historical precedent, things like the Underground Railroad, where people would put themselves in great jeopardy, often for the freedom of others, and how the Lord moved on that. We talk a little bit about the homosexual agenda and how they are leaning into adoption. Fastest growing group of adopting people are homosexuals because, in a sense, it legitimizes their family. They've got the white picket fence and the golden retriever, but now we've got to go to adopt to get a child. And while the church is yelling things in front of the clinic and holding signs up, very quietly, the homosexual community is adopting children like crazy. Who will influence the next generation? It'll be the family they grew up in.
And how do you feel about kids that grow up in a home with either two moms or two dads?
I just don't know how that child could ever have a, short of, you know, God doing a major work, have a biblical perspective of gender, mm-hmm. of roles, of biblical family. You know, those are all things that we all, you know, struggle through adolescence and find ourselves to, but at least in raised in a traditional family of a mom and dad, at least you've got roles to lean back on. And I'm just, I'm bothered that, you know, kids are being brought into homosexual homes to legitimize their arrangement, when, you know, the child is at risk.
Yeah, and it also guarantees, it's not like a single-parent home, it guarantees that that child will either never have a mother or never have a father, and with that see a wrong modeling of roles. And one gal who was raised by a very openly homosexual dad said she never got to see how a man should treat a woman. And just very simple things like that. Hey, Randy, Zoe Foundation is the website. I really appreciate what you're doing. And if you will send me a copy of your book, which I don't have yet, I will plug it here on the radio show. Is that a deal?
We will absolutely send one your way. Thank you.
All right. Thanks for being with me, Randy. I appreciate it very much. Randy Bollinger, the Zoe Foundation, his new book, The Spirit of Adoption. Go to AskDrBrown.org. Click on the line of fire, and you will have links to Randy's website, to his blog, to his book, Spirit of Adoption. Who knows what the Lord could do for you and your family? Hey, do you want to hear something cool? Check this out. Next hour, 10:30 a.m., our friends listening in Raleigh, none other than Dr. James Dobson will be on with Steve Noble. So tune in, those listening on 10:30. Keep listening. And something even more cool. No. I am not more cool than Dr. Dobson. No. Of course not. However, you get to meet me personally. I get to meet you personally tomorrow, 12 noon. All those Triad listeners, Haynes Mall, Golden Corral, and Winston-Salem. I'll be treating you to lunch there. Yeah, I know. It's not the finest steakhouse in the city, but I'll be treating you to lunch and giving you a free DVD. How's that? A two-hour debate, lively debate. Talk about a debate. With my friend Rabbi Shmuley Boteach about homosexuality. We'll be giving you a free DVD, treating you to lunch, and hanging out together beginning at 12 noon. But we need to know if you're coming because seating is limited. So call us and tell us you're coming. We don't have child care. This is just for adults. 888-378-FIRE. Give us a call. Tell us you're coming. 888-378-3473. That's tomorrow. That's the last time I can announce it. 12 noon. All right. Can't wait to see you there. I'm really going to share some things that will encourage you, charge you, let you know some amazing things set before us. All right. There's something very significant that's happened. I was talking to Randy Bolander the first part of the show today. Very significant to hear how many Christians are being moved to say pro-life is pro-child. Pro-child also means pro-adoption. I'm sure this has been happening for years in pockets and circles, but on a much wider level now, Christians are grabbing a bird and say, hey, there are kids out there needing adoption. There are kids out there that are going to go into foster care. There are kids out there in need. We can open the doors in our home, not just if we can't have our own kids, but in addition to the biological kids we have. During the Vietnamese boat crisis, late 70s, early 80s, it was our great privilege and joy as a household to open our home throughout our church. Just about everybody that had an extra room or a couch, we just opened our home to Vietnamese refugees that were pouring in from all over the world. And pouring in, there were refugees and being taken in by different countries and coming in with tremendous needs, tremendous pain, tremendous hardship they had suffered. We have the privilege of taking a mom and dad and their baby and then taking in another a few other single guys and others, and different families would take folks in. And boy, I'll tell you, not only was it a privilege, it was enriching to our family to be able to serve these people. What a great calling Randy shared with us. And again, his book, Spirit of Adoption, talks about it more. I've just glimpsed at it, so he's got to send me a copy so I can plug it to you even more. Very significant, though, to know that public opinion continues to shift. Francis Kissling, former president of Catholics for Choice, leading figure in the pro-abortion community, has advised the abortion movement to stop ignoring the humanity of the unborn child before the tidal wave of pro-life popularity washes away pro-abortion laws altogether. This is according to an article on LifeSite News. Listen to what Kissling said. Pro-choice arguments concerning a woman's privacy are dangerously outdated. The chant we heard earlier in the program is, my body, my choice, my body, my choice. He said it's dangerously outdated. Come on. There was a time when, talking about pro-life, you were completely marginalized. There was a time when it seemed that the pro-choice, meaning the pro-abortion position, which was anything but pro-choice, that they just won the day and we weren't going to turn back. Listen to what Kissling says. Abortion is a private decision, we say, and the state has no power over a woman's body. Those arguments may have worked in the 1970s, but today they are failing us, and focusing on them only risks all the gains we've made, she writes. The pro-choice brand has eroded considerably. Listen to this quote. We can no longer pretend the fetus is invisible. And of course, they still have to call it the fetus. They can't call it a child. She says this is a pro-choice Catholic. Figure that out. We can no longer pretend the fetus is invisible. We must end the fiction that an abortion at 26 weeks is no different from when it's 6 weeks. The fetus is more visible than ever before, and the abortion rights movement needs to accept its existence and its value. And she also says, unfortunately, we're not going to regain the ground we have lost. That means that the holistic care for life, the holistic concern for the child, cannot simply be a matter of don't kill the baby in the womb. It can't simply be that we are pro-life when it comes to the baby in the womb. It has to mean that we are actively involved in ministering to the needs of families that are hurting. It has to mean that we are caring for those in underprivileged homes and kids with special needs. It has to mean that Christian doors in particular are open to adoption. And again, as Randy said, this is not for everybody. And when the Holy Spirit moves on his children, he doesn't move with a guilt trip, but he'll plant a seed. Oh, it may be challenging, and there's a cross, but he'll plant that seed, and before you know it, the desire is there. Perhaps the Lord is speaking to you about these things. If you go to the Zoe Foundation, we've got the link on the Line of Fire website. If you go to the Zoe Foundation, you'll get information, practical steps you can take. When we come back, a very revealing audio clip from a college campus. All right, don't forget Dr. Dobson with Steve Noble, 10:30 a.m. right after my program here today. Michael Brown, thank you for joining us. Hey, this is just another aspect of moral, cultural, spiritual revolution in the name of Jesus. By the life and power of the Spirit, we live differently, even right to our families, right to the business place, right to our private lives, right to our values and the things that we give ourselves to. On our Voice of Revolution magazine, we have a link to Center for Bioethical Reform. You'll want to go there and watch a couple of these video clips. But there's some background noise, but you'll be able to hear this woman answering a charge about, well, why are you comparing the slaughter of people in Rwanda to abortion? Listen to this very intense little dialogue.
But what I want to say is I feel like what I find completely offensive about your pictures and how it's a manipulation is you're trying to give us a message that butchered children in Rwanda, butchered children in America, but then I see these pictures of a 26-year-old severed head or the 24-year-old aborted baby. Are those pictures in America too?
Well, these are images of injustice that indeed happens in America over a million times a year.
That severed head stuff happens in America?
Yes, in America, dilation and evacuation is a later term abortion. And that happens whereby the abortionist puts in the medical instrument, grabs whatever he feels, because abortion is generally a blind procedure, and pulls out arms, pulls out legs, pulls out head. So all of that does happen. A D&E is a commonplace procedure here in America. In terms of butchered children in Rwanda versus America, I was once standing with this picture and a woman from Rwanda walked by. And most of her family had been killed in the genocide. And I became really self-conscious about what I was standing next to, because I did not know how she was going to think about me or what she was going to say. So I simply asked her, how do you feel about us comparing this
to this? I don't feel very
good
about you guys.
She looked in silence at the image for 20 seconds.
We're not silent.
Then she pointed to the picture of the aborted child, and she said, that's worse, because at least my family could try to run away.
All right. Notice the calmness of the woman speaking there and the hecklers. Something gets provoked, friend, because it really is a confrontation between light and darkness and life and death. And I want to give you my bottom line for today. Friends, light shines in the darkness and light will ultimately overcome. Life rises in the midst of death and life will ultimately overcome. The path of the righteous is like the first gleam of dawn, shining brighter and brighter until full noon of day. There was a time when public opinion was so hostile to those talking about the sanctity of life in the womb. There was a time before ultrasounds. There was a time before 4D ultrasounds. There was a time before the current wave that is turning many hearts today, especially among the young people. There was such hostility to the concept of pro-life. Then they began to realize we got a whole generation that's been wiped out. We've got so many that could have been here with us. Lights begin to go on. People begin to see the humanity of the child in the womb. Even the pro-abortion people saying you can't look at the invisibility of the child anymore. In other words, something's happening in the consciousness of a nation, and the conscience of a nation, and the consciousness of a nation. A tide is turning. We can't just rely on political force alone to bring about change, or the courts alone to bring about change. It's ultimately the role of the church, the God's people, to bring about change. But be encouraged. Be encouraged, because things that seemed impossible 20 years ago are much more possible now. And those who for years and years and years fought and were the tiny, tiny minority fighting for the rights of the unborn, they can see today their labors have not been in vain. May everyone be encouraged. Your labor for the Lord is never in vain. Hope to see you tomorrow at our luncheon, Winston-Salem, 12 noon. Call us if you're coming now, 888-378-FIRE.